The issue of the Journal of Philosophical Investigations for April of 2001 contains a brief statement by 13 prominent philosophers for whom Wittgenstein has been important. They were asked to give an account of how they came to be acquainted with Wittgenstein's work, the way it had influenced their work, their own work in philosophy, and their view of Wittgenstein in relation to contemporary trends in the field. In all, the issue offers a thought-provoking array of perspectives. One theme that seems to unite many of the contributors is the feeling that during the last two decades or so, philosophers in the analytical tradition have increasingly come to look upon their approaches to philosophy inspired by the later Wittgenstein as a superseded stage in the history of the discipline. This observation fitted in with my own impressions. This trend is noted in particular by Peter Hacker and Carl Diamond. Hacker says that, quote, philosophy has turned away from Wittgenstein. A form of scientism has come to dominate philosophy of language and philosophy of mind, and to give licenses to scientific metaphysics. It isn't that Wittgenstein's arguments have been refuted. Indeed, it's doubtful whether they have been understood at all by philosophers who seek to emulate the sciences. End of quote. Cora Diamond writes that, quote, Wittgenstein's writings are pretty plainly taken to be largely irrelevant to most contemporary philosophical thought in the English-speaking world. End of quote. I think she might have added to that in the Scandinavian-speaking world as well, with Norway as a possible exception. As evidence of Wittgenstein's current standing, she refers to the 1996 supplement to the Encyclopedia of Philosophy, which is supposed to cover developments since the appearance of the Encyclopedia in 1967. She notes that, quote, there's nothing on Wittgenstein on knowledge, belief, certainty or skepticism. No index reference to Wittgenstein on mind, or mind-body problem, or philosophy of mind. Judging again from the supplement, Wittgenstein is a non-figure for post-1967 philosophy of logic. I had myself had similar feelings about the recent 9-volume Routledge Encyclopedia of Philosophy. Trying to confirm my impression, I checked the index, and I found that certain philosophers in the tradition from Wittgenstein, such as Vers Rees and Carl Diamond, were almost totally neglected. There were two references to Rees, one for an article on John Anderson, and the other for the book of recollections on Wittgenstein that he edited. And the single reference to Diamond for having edited the volume honoring Elizabeth Enscombe. For comparison, there are 10 references to a philosopher like Christine Korsmore. And in the article on Wittgenstein, Saul Kripke is singled out as the one outstanding guy in his later thought. Again, from her own experience, Cora Diamond speaks about the need to advise students with an interest in Wittgenstein that, if it's possible for them to do so, they play down that interest when they apply for positions teaching philosophy. End of quote. And I believe that many of us have discovered that explicit references to Wittgenstein or appeals to the ordinary use of words are often frowned upon in philosophical debates. In the leading journals of the field, one would rarely find a work, say, by Quine or Davidson, or written in their spirit, reviewed by someone from a Wittgensteinian tradition. Well, it's quite common for philosophers, say, of a Quinean or Davidsonian, or generally analytical persuasion, to review works written by philosophers influenced by Wittgenstein. The latter is, of course, entirely as it should be. It's the former situation that's regrettable. Evidently, where the core areas of philosophy are concerned, there's assumed to be an asymmetry of qualification. This marginalization of Wittgenstein often takes a form of regarding philosophers working in the Wittgensteinian tradition as forming their own enclave. In some connections, they are taken to represent a special competence in the history of philosophy. The message is clear: Wittgenstein is history, or at least he should be. My use of the term analytical philosophy requires a comment. The term is, of course, elastic. In a wide sense, Wittgenstein would undoubtedly count as an analytical philosopher, but in a narrower sense, the term is used to exclude him. In fact, the relation between Wittgenstein and analytical philosophy is something as a paradox, since much of what's known today by that name came from under Wittgenstein's overcoat, as it were. I'm not only thinking of the impact of the Tractatus, as rightly or wrongly understood. His later work too has had an impact, sometimes direct, sometimes indirect, on most of the work done in English-speaking philosophy since the Second World War. Of course, speaking about the tradition from Wittgenstein is misleading too. As is well known, Wittgenstein's influence has taken different forms among different philosophers. This variation is connected with different views of the inner continuity of Wittgenstein's work, as well as its continuity with the work preceding or surrounding it. Sometimes these variations express deep-lying differences in outlook and method. I think that this variation is a source of strength. Now, are we to think about the neglect of Wittgenstein among mainstream analytical philosophers as foreboding a breakup of the analytical tradition, an analogue of what that which occurred with the once unified European tradition in the 19th century, when the world of philosophy broke apart into a predominantly German and a predominantly Anglo-Saxon form? I don't believe that that rupture provides a model for what's happening now. Tragic as it was, the two traditions have managed to live on more or less independently of one another. They don't need one another, or at least they like to pretend that they don't. However, the relation between the way of doing philosophy that was inspired by Wittgenstein and analytical philosophy, in the narrow sense, is not comparable to the relation between so-called continental and so-called analytical philosophy. The tradition from Wittgenstein just could not go on existing in splendid isolation from the rest of philosophy without losing what I would argue is its very raison d'etre. Critical reflection on the conditions and presuppositions of philosophical thought in general. The way I see it then, critical interaction with other more conventional ways of doing philosophy is the very lifeblood of the Wittgensteinian tradition. Clearly, then, the Wittgensteinian traditions seem to be offering something that the other side doesn't want. It can't simply be the fact that it's criticism, since mutual criticism is the very air that philosophy breathes. What the mainstream wants to ignore, for some reason, is this particular form of criticism. Evidently, it's felt that this criticism isn't getting us anywhere, that for some reason these objections are powerless, uninteresting, or irrelevant. We should recall that this wasn't always so. The situation was quite different in the first two decades following Wittgenstein's death. And we might feel an impulse to look for an explanation for the change. However, I believe it would be hard to do so without yielding to the temptation to indulge in idle speculation or to vent one's prejudices. So I'm not going to look for an explanation. What I should like to try to do, rather, is to formulate what it is that, in my view, the analytical world will be losing if it persists in turning its back on these approaches. In doing so, I shall inevitably be expressing my own understanding of what's distinctive and worthwhile about Wittgenstein's contribution to philosophy. I don't wish to claim that what I'm going to say is original in any sense. In giving the title for my talk, I was trying to express why I thought it would be a bad thing for analytical philosophy to disinherit itself from the Wittgensteinian influence. I first gave it in the form "keeping philosophy honest," but then it struck me that that formulation was liable to be misleading, so I changed it to "trying to keep philosophy honest." I tried to explain why. To say that Wittgenstein and philosophers inspired by him are needed to keep philosophy honest would give an unwelcome moralistic slant to the claim. It's not a matter of taking the moral high ground. Any such pretension would probably have struck Wittgenstein himself as abhorrent. Rather, the point is that Wittgenstein's conception of the difficulties of philosophy differed from that of most philosophers before him. For him, a concern with one's intellectual honesty is internal to the difficulty of philosophy. This aspect is made explicit in some of the manuscripts preparatory for philosophical investigations, more clearly than in the investigations themselves. In Culture and Value, we read the oft-quoted remark from 1931. This is number one on the handout. Work on philosophy, like work in architecture in many respects, is really more, or rather, work on oneself, on one's own conception, on how one sees things, and what one expects from them. And in 1947, Wittgenstein wrote, this is also in Culture and Value, In fact, it's already a seed of good originality not to want to be what you are not. In the big typeshift from the early 30s, there's a following chapter heading. Difficulty of philosophy, not the intellectual difficulty of the sciences, but the difficulty of a change of attitude. Resistances of the will must be overcome. What makes the difficulties of philosophy so intractable, Wittgenstein thought, is the fact that in grappling with them, we must constantly struggle against our intellectual temptations. I shall try to bring out the nature of this concern by focusing on certain themes in Wittgenstein's later thoughts. What I shall have to say can be considered a meditation on three remarks by Wittgenstein. My comments can be seen as an attempt to come at the same theme from three slightly different directions. The first remark is Philosophical Investigations, 116. It's number four on the handout. When philosophers use a word, knowledge, being, object, I, sentence, name, and try to grasp the essence of the thing, one must always ask oneself, is the word ever actually used in this way in the language game, which is its original home? What we do is bring words back from their metaphysical to their everyday use. Philosophers tend to be suspicious of the idea that they should be under obligation to bring words back to their everyday use. Wittgenstein, one might think, is just arbitrarily assigning a normative or honorary status to everyday language. Why shouldn't the specialized forms of discourse of the various academic disciplines, say, be regarded as equally legitimate in their own contexts? Or then again, if that right is granted them, why should not the same courtesies be extended to philosophers? Don't they, too, have a need for their own conceptual apparatus? Wittgenstein here seems to be indulging in an arbitrary piece of philosophical lawmaking, thus infringing his own aphorism that philosophy may in no way interfere with the actual use of language but can only describe it. Now, obviously, any such reading would be at odds with the spirit of Wittgenstein's work in philosophy, and of course, those who attribute this view to him have simply read this remark carelessly. There's no suggestion here that anything is to be prohibited. Wittgenstein is first recommending that we take up a certain attitude towards the philosopher who claims to be trying to grasp the essence of the object of his inquiry. And second, he is giving an account of his own method in philosophy. The philosopher says something, say, about knowledge, for instance, that there can be no genuine knowledge of empirical facts, since the possibility of error can never absolutely be excluded. Wittgenstein is telling us to try to bring that claim into contact with the ways in which we ordinarily speak about knowledge. Consider G.E. Moore as someone who is trying to make a different claim about the essence of knowledge. In saying things like, I know that this is a hand, he wanted to give an example of a knowledge claim that no one could question. I think he never actually used that example as a case of knowledge, but that's the way it has been understood in the commentary. He wanted to give an example of a knowledge claim that no one could question. And much of uncertainty is taken up with an effort to show why Moore's attempt to refute skepticism in this way is misguided. That is in Wittgenstein's discussion of Moore. Wittgenstein does so in part by reminding us that we wouldn't claim to know the sort of thing. We wouldn't claim to know the sort of thing Moore gives as examples of knowledge, or we might do so at most in very unusual circumstances. On the other hand, Wittgenstein asks, why doesn't Moore produce as one of the things that he knows, for example, that in such and such part of England, there's a village called so and so. In other words, why doesn't he mention a fact that's known to him and not to every one of us? End of quote. The advantage of such an example would have been that it brings to life the sort of discussion in which someone might actually make a claim to know something. Here's a situation in which something may actually depend on how the issue is resolved, and where people might have some idea of what would be relevant arguments in favour of the claim or against it. In such a context, something will count as being justified or not being justified in making the claim. What Moore thinks he needs in order to make his point against the skeptic is a claim that couldn't turn out false, whatever happened. If a knowledge claim is only conditionally, hypothetically valid, it's not, strictly speaking, a knowledge claim. It's not a countercase to the skeptic. However, Moore appears to be confusing the requirement that the claim should be unconditionally valid with its validity being independent of its context, a confusion that he shares with the skeptic. But the context is not something that conditions a claim. To imagine a different context for an utterance is to imagine a different claim being made, a different action being performed, as it were. If I accept a claim as unconditionally valid in a specific situation, I didn't worry about the fact that the same utterance in a different situation might be found to express a claim that's unwarranted or even false. Moore apparently doesn't realize this. Rather, he wants to rise to this skeptic's challenge, finding an example of a knowledge claim for which we can imagine no context in which it could be doubted. However, in doing so, he ends up with a claim for which we can imagine no use. What makes these examples particularly powerful to Moore is precisely that which makes them into non-examples of knowledge claims. Now, it might be thought that I have a lot riding here on the notion of a context. How can we tell whether the context is or is not the same, for instance? Now, this question would be pertinent if it were thought to be the task of philosophical inquiry to decide which matters can be known with certainty. But that's not the point. Rather, it's simply a matter of reminding ourselves how knowledge claims are used, that they are put forward and adjudicated in various ways by actual people in actual situations. I know this is one of the things we may say in the course of a conversation, but so is no, you're wrong, or how can you be so certain? The question of what we do or don't have a right to say is raised and settled in those particular situations. The idea that there might be some standard for the correct use of our expressions, external to their actual use, is an illusion. The ultimate aim of the philosophical activity is to make us recognize that the idea that there is something we want to say is an illusion. In fact, the conventional retort to Wittgenstein's remark about metaphysical and everyday use, according to which philosophy must have a right to its own specialized terminology, is disingenuous, since at the same time the philosophers who invoke this defense are presuming to tell us a deeper truth about what we understand by knowledge. In other words, the philosopher claims the right to use a word differently from others and yet mean the same by it, as Wittgenstein remarks in, Investigations 117, that's number 5 of the handout. You say to me, you understand this expression, don't you? Well then, I'm using it in the sense you're familiar with. As if the sense were an atmosphere accompanying the word, which it carried with it into every kind of application. If, for example, someone says to the sentence, this is here, saying which he points to an object in front of him, makes sense to him, then he should ask himself, in what special circumstances this sentence is actually used. There it does make sense. Now the problem with the skeptics' examples, as well as with Moore's response, is that they paralyze our imagination. Moore is afflicted with a condition which seems to be an occupational hazard with many analytical philosophers, what I should like to call use deafness. By this I don't simply mean insensitivity to differences in nuance between variously closely related expressions, but the failure to consider the radical difference it makes whether we try to recall the relevant expression in actual conversation, or whether we simply, as it were, test the word on our tongue in the solitude of our study. Philosophers tend to be reluctant to think about the way words are used by people who utter them because they have something to say, and about the bearing what they are saying will have on how their words are taken. What I have called use deafness is closely related to what Wittgenstein called a one-sided diet of examples. This takes us to our second theme. The second remark I wish to comment on is Investigations 593, that's number 6 of the handout. A main cause of philosophical disease, a one-sided diet. One nourishes one's thinking with only one kind of example. Now, most philosophers do use examples to a greater or lesser extent as part of their argument or presentation. However, their attitudes towards the examples they use may vary a great deal. Quite often, examples are used for what we might call illustrative purposes. Telling a little story may be a convenient way of cutting short an explanation, or conveying what's meant by some abstract formulation. Whether one uses these kinds of examples or not is mainly a matter of stylistic preference, and it doesn't have any great bearing on the thinking itself. The writer knows what he wants the example to do, and the example he hopes will do it. It's just a way of conveying to his reader something that he feels he is already clear about himself. However, there's another way of using examples in which reflecting on the example becomes part of the work of clarification itself. This is the case when we don't know where we're going, or when we think we know, but the example takes us by surprise. In fact, I believe this attitude is tremendously important in philosophy, and very hard too, since it means being prepared to relinquish our control over where the line of thought is taking us. I think teaching students to write philosophy is partly a matter of teaching them the patience to stop and look for examples. This requires fighting your own impulses. Having to look for examples you feel slows you down. The examples get in your way. They don't let you go where you're going, or they only get you there through a detour. I should like to suggest that in this respect there's a continuum between good philosophy and good literature. D.H. Lawrence once said, if you try to nail anything down in the novel, either it kills the novel, or the novel gets up and goes away with the nail. I wouldn't vouch for how well Lawrence himself lived up to this insight, maybe he realized it's important from bitter experience. Anyway, a similar attitude is sometimes expressed by writers of fiction, who insist that they can't control or predict what their characters will do. Writers who say this are not necessarily being coy, rather they are expressing an insight that's connected with the kind of importance that literature can have. Wittgenstein evidently thought that something very similar was true for philosophy. In response to the idea that all games must have something in common, he said, don't think, but look. If you're locked in your categories, Your only chance of freeing yourself is by thinking the case is true. In this respect, of course, his view of the discipline constitutes an almost complete reversal of the conventional view. Philosophy, it has usually been thought, is the art par excellence of nailing things down. Almost inevitably, the received understanding of philosophy has colored the reading of Wittgenstein himself. There have been endless arguments as to whether he actually did nail it down, that there can't be solitary speakers, that there is or is not such a thing as private experience, that meaning is identical with use, etc. It is perhaps because of the central role of examples in the investigations and their nearly total absence from the Tractatus, more than anything else, that I feel the distance between those two works to be so great. The Tractatus has its own kind of concreteness, but it's a very different kind. I would like to note here in passing that the uses and misuses of examples in philosophy seems to be a topic that hasn't, on the whole, received the attention it deserves. It might be interesting to do a study of the use of examples by Wittgenstein and by the philosophers who have been inspired by him. Different kinds of examples are used to make different kinds of points. Wittgenstein's own examples are often sparse, sometimes intentionally quite outlandish, like the case of the shopkeeper who checks the color of his apples against the color chart, or the tribe where you pay for good by the area, not the volume. O.K. Bausman's and Stanley Cavell's examples are imaginative, while those of Rush Rees are usually quite down to earth, taken from everyday life, from the world around us. Jakob Mele has continued along this path, using elaborate examples from his own life word, examples which he leaves to speak for themselves, keeping the philosophical commentary to at a minimum. Peter Winch and Desert Phillips use stories from literature. The American philosopher Don S. Levy, inspired, I believe, by Bausman, grabs the philosopher examples by the horns, showing how a position can be dissolved very effectively by taking the philosopher at his words, by trying to imagine that the philosopher is speaking a language that we can all understand. The point of using examples in philosophy is sometimes misunderstood. It might be thought that their use as tools of thought must be in conflict with the understanding of philosophy as a reflective exercise rather than an empirical investigation. And there's some confusion about what examples are supposed to prove, or in what sense anything can be learned from fantastic thought experiments, or from examples taken from fiction. The point, of course, is that examples are precisely an aid to reflection. They are a method for making us face up to what we already know. Ever since Socrates, one would like to say, philosophy has existed in the space between what we like to think we understand and what we really do understand. To see how attitudes toward examples may differ, we might think of a case in which what's introduced for the sake of harmless illustration may itself come alive, turning to a tool for exploration. One of the best known examples in contemporary philosophy comes from Word and Object by Quine. He writes, a rabbit scurries by, the native says, gabagai, and the linguist notes down the sentence, rabbit or lo a rabbit, as tentative translation, subject to testing in further cases. And later on, Quine comments, this comment is on the handout, number 7. Who knows about what the objects to which this term, gabagai, applies are not rabbits after all, but mere stages or brief temporal segments of rabbits. In either event, the similar situations that prompt assent to gabagai would be the same as for a rabbit. Or perhaps the objects to which gabagai applies are all and sundry undetouched parts of rabbits. Again, the stimulus meaning would register no difference. When from the sameness of stimulus, meanings of gabagai and rabbit, the linguist leaps to the conclusion that a gabagai is a whole enduring rabbit, he's just taking for granted that the native is enough like us to have a brief general term for rabbits and no brief general term for rabbit stages or parts. Now, this example has a central role in Quine's argument for the indeterminacy of translation. What he is arguing is that we can't, strictly speaking, know whether some morpheme of our language is a correct translation of some morpheme in an alien language, since all we have to go on, as far as the alien language is concerned, is the correlation between the natives uttering the word and their being exposed to a certain stimulus. And any given stimulus is compatible with any number of different translations into our own language. Thus, unless we illicitly take it for granted that the natives are similar to us in their patterns of interest and attention, we have no logically compelling reason to assume that the word comes the most naturally to mind when we are exposed to a certain stimulus. We will be the one that comes most naturally to mind when the native is. However, when we consider this example more closely, it comes to look rather peculiar. What precisely are the linguist and his informant, let's call them Robinson and Friday, up to out there on the moor, as I mentioned them? What does Friday take himself to be doing? Is he acting the part of informant? And if he is, how does he understand his part? Does he realize that Robinson is studying his language? And is he clear what kind of activity that is? Or are we to suppose that he goes about his life as usual, addressing Robinson the way he would one of his tribesmen, the way people who are unused to foreign speakers will sometimes do? If so, what reason do we have to suppose that he's indicating the species of the animals scurrying by, let alone talking about rabbit stages or undetached rabbit parts? Are rabbits rare in those parts? Do rabbit parts have a special importance in their culture? The way rabbit paws are said to bring luck in some parts of the world. Does the word gabagai press forth in astonishment? Is it a warning, an exhortation to get the gun or the camera ready, an aesthetic response, or something else? Does Friday have a life at all? The point is that it doesn't seem to matter. On Quine's account, the speaker can be ignored. He is transparent, a mere appendage to the language. His role is reduced to the production of sounds in the presence of a stimulus. But if his life is kept out of the picture, what we are left with is not a language, just pointless phonic responses. The problem, from Quine's point of view, is that the example may not stop where he tells it to stop. What we realize, if we go on with it, is how little can in fact be learned about the problem of interpreting an alien language by contemplating an example such as Quine's. The discussion is in the tradition of supposing that questions of language and meaning are simply questions about correlation between sounds and events. Quine, it seems, is trying to get by on a one-sided diet of examples, or better perhaps, on a one-sided use of examples. He's pussyfooting around the example in fear of getting his feet wet. And then I want to conclude by commenting on certainty 549, that's number 8. Pretensions are a mortgage which burdens a philosopher's capacity to think. In mortgaging your house for a loan, you limit your freedom to dispose of your property as you see fit. Wittgenstein apparently thinks the philosopher who sets up a goal for herself is similarly giving up the freedom to follow her thought wherever it takes her. She is no longer at liberty to question her understanding of the terms in which she has defined her goal, unless, that is, she is ready, if need be, to relinquish that goal itself as unintelligible. Philosophers are all acquainted with the dreaded question, what is it that you philosophers really do? And with the difficulty of coming up with an answer that will satisfy one's interlocutor concerning the utility of one's trade. Our reaction to this difficulty may be divided. We are perhaps embarrassed by it, feeling that we should be able to come up with an answer. At other times, perhaps, we have felt an impulse to rise to the challenge, to give a characterization of the sort of contribution one takes themselves to be making, in terms external to philosophy itself. Thus, philosophers from time to time will maintain that the profession derives its importance from its current ability to contribute to the advancement of rational thought, the progress of science, to our emancipation from certain oppressive structures, to living the good life, etc. However, even when philosophers do define the contribution they want to make in some such terms, most of the time the declaration shouldn't be taken literally. In issuing declarations on the importance of philosophy, philosophers for the most part are not identifying the purpose by which they actually set their compass. The declarations are a kind of sham. This should be clear from the fact that a divergence of declared purpose doesn't necessarily prevent philosophers from participating in the same collaborative activities. And on the other hand, philosophers who agree on their declared aims may yet disagree vehemently on how the activity should be carried out. This suggests that whatever philosophers may claim, their work usually doesn't get its direction from external purposes, but from inside itself. In fact, on Wittgenstein's conception, our wish to explain what philosophy is about should be recognized as a temptation. Philosophical thought is the preoccupation with philosophical bewilderment. We might say, philosophy is looking at the world through the eyes of bewilderment. Being bewildered means that you don't know where you're going. As Wittgenstein put it, a philosophical problem has the form, I don't know my way about. If you knew where you are going, you would no longer be a bewildered. Hence, in that instant, you would not be doing philosophy. If someone else is bewildered and you can't share her bewilderment, you can't help her in philosophy. We might say, bewilderment gives philosophy its direction. Or better, perhaps, in philosophy, there are no directions. The wish to say where philosophy will get you is an attempt to think around the bewilderment. This you can only do by stepping outside of philosophy or leaving it behind. So you could say you can only set an agenda for your work in philosophy by sidestepping philosophy. What must be resisted in philosophy is the urge to think that we are already clear about the main thing. An expression of this urge is the metaphysical must, the idea that we can tell how things are without looking. It must be like this. This goes with the idea that in matters of reflection, as opposed to empirical matters, we always already know the answers. The danger of this attitude, what we might call a priorism, is that we remain locked in the cage of our preconceived notions. Wherever we look, we only seem to see our own ideas confirmed. The scientific metaphysics that Peter Hackett talks about is one form of this, but there are many other forms. We might travesty Wittgenstein's own words. Not empiricism and not yet a priorism in philosophy, that's the hardest thing. The greatest loss to analytical philosophy, if the impulses from Wittgenstein were finally silenced, would be the loss of something that can bring us out of our self-preoccupation. Thank you.